This is an ABC podcast.
This is Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia.
Hello, and welcome to Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Wendy Mockey. I'm speaking with Gabrielle Tor, a clinician and researcher based in Beaverton, Oregon, USA, where she was also raised. Gabrielle is used to doing the listening, but today she's in the opposite seat. With a father from Vanuatu and a mother who worked in healthcare, Gabrielle entered clinical psychology already aware that her people, their stories, their ways of healing were largely missing from the conversation. Through her work, Gabrielle is challenging Western frameworks, centering community as medicine, and connecting the dots between climate grief, cultural survival, and psychological care. Welcome to the show, Gabrielle.
Thank you.
Now, you were born and raised in Oregon, USA, a place where most people thought Pacific Islander meant Hawaiian, and Melanesia wasn't even on the map. For a long time, you didn't realize just how different your family was until classmates started asking questions. What was it like growing up in a place where your culture was rarely reflected?
It was interesting. It was sort of like putting pieces together little by little. In the part of Oregon where I grew up, there is a larger community of like Hawaiians. And so when naturally, of course, like you said, when people thought Pacific Islander, they just thought Hawaiian. That's usually, at least in my experience, what most folks are taught in American schools. And so going back home when we had Melanesian culture, Ngāi Vanuatu culture, it felt like it was just this very precious small thing that we just had as a family. But yeah, I didn't really get the chance to share it with other people because we were the only ones for the longest time. And I didn't really get the experience to share in it with others until I was an adult and I got to like start visiting and seeing family that were overseas. Yeah.
And when did you first start to feel the weight of being othered?
I would say maybe middle or high school. That was around the time when people's questions started to get a little bit more intrusive, a little bit more poking onto sore spots. And I think it also had to do just largely with the timing of things politically in the United States overall at that time, especially when I was in high school around 2016. There was a lot of inflammatory things circling around about racism, about different ethnicities. And that contributed to people being insensitive more, as well as just being high schoolers, teenagers. And that's when it really started to feel like, oh, yes, that sense of otherness.
And what was it like for your family to raise children in a place without necessarily a strong Pacific Islander community? Like, how did the parents kind of navigate that in terms of raising a family?
Yeah, that also was kind of patchwork, kind of quilting things together, so to speak, or weaving things together. Like we knew that there weren't a lot of people like us, but that made my parents all the more willing to go like leaps and bounds to make sure that we had that sense of community. We would have reunions or gatherings with other folks that were from Vanuatu, with aunties and uncles, with people from all over different regions in Canada, in Baltimore, and in Washington. And those were really special times. That's where I really got to see my parents thrive in a special way too, getting to speak their languages and share memories in that way. Those were really special.
Now, do you mention before, you've always been a listener and someone tuned into what people don't say out loud, I would say. But it wasn't until your mum, a nurse practitioner, started sharing stories about patient care that you began to understand the emotional labor behind healing. That, combined with your own curiosity, led you to psychology. Still, even as you applied to grad school, you questioned whether you belonged. Now, it took time to realize your perspective. Your perspective wasn't just valid. It was vital. I'm wondering, what did you notice or feel when you first stepped into the world of psychology?
I knew for a long time, I think probably just from watching my mom grow in her own career, that I wanted to have a career that focused on helping other people with their health, and mental health was the thing that spoke to me the most. And As I was completing my bachelor's in psychology, I knew that I wanted to be a clinician, not just because I wanted to have like that one-on-one time with people and have that particular focus, but also because I wanted to make sure that the people that I was serving got to be served by someone who looked like them. And even if they didn't, even if I didn't look like them, I knew a bit about what they were going through in terms of feeling othered or feeling all of the other smaller experiences that maybe aren't talked about as much. Like when your family is overseas and you're here, you know, and, or you're seeing things happening in your home country through headlines on BBC, you know, and the particular emotional strain that can come from things like that. I wanted to make sure that people knew that they weren't the only ones that knew about that experience, that they could talk to someone in mental health who knew what that was, that didn't need that explained to them.
That's so important. Yeah, it does such wonders knowing that the person that you're sharing or opening up parts of yourself to can really understand you on a much more deeper level than what you would necessarily get from someone who may not be from the same community or, you know, able to relate to. I'm wondering, was there a specific moment where you felt like, yes, this is what I meant to do?
I think when I was doing my first bits of my project for my master's degree, I got the chance to present on clinical considerations for Pacific Islanders with mental health field and the things that would be important for someone who isn't a part of that community to know if they had patients in that, like within that demographic, and getting to teach from that perspective and talk about how important it is to like hone our practice as practitioners, as clinicians, to do that uniquely and use it as a strength. I got so passionate about it, and I didn't expect to get so passionate about it, but I did. And I thought to myself, no, I think this is what I need to do. I think there's something here. Yeah. And that's what sparked where I am now and where I hope to be as well as I continue.
Amazing. And what role did mentorship play in helping you find your confidence in this space?
I think it's played a huge role. I work as a board member for Melanesian Women Today under Dr. Mary Tarasovic, and that has been a really special experience. She, growing up, yeah, she was my auntie. And so getting to work with her as an adult has been really, really special. And getting, because I've gotten to work with her and she has the perspective of like, no, you and your friends and your colleagues are the future. And we need to make sure that you are getting the chance and the platform to explore like what you have to give. And that did a lot for my confidence. I struggle with feeling like I'm good enough for this kind of work at some point. I don't know a single clinician who doesn't feel that way, at least at some point. But yeah, her vote of confidence in my ideas and her just the opportunity to work with her has been really, really impactful for me in that way.
That's wonderful and special to be mentored by aunties. Aunties are so important and vital to our communities, and to be able to have that relationship and be mentored by an auntie is phenomenal. Mm-hmm. Now, even as a kid, you were drawn to other people's emotions, so much so that you got in trouble at school, not for talking, but for listening too closely to everyone but the teacher. Now that couldn't be me. Let me just say that firstly. I was the opposite kid. I was the one doing all talking. Now, that instinct to hold space for others, paired with your mom's stories as an oncology nurse, led you to study psychology. But the deeper you went, the clearer it became. Melanesians and Pacific Islanders more broadly were barely visible in the research, counted out, deemed too small to study. And that realization lit a fire in you. What was it like to realize your own community was left out of the field you were training in?
Oh, it has always been so angering. I see it less so now, but yeah, growing up, even like in high school and reading articles with that reasoning of like, no, the N of Pacific Islanders, the N of Melanesians is just too small to justify like its own independent research. We'll just clump them in all together with no respect to the nuance or the broadness of what Pacific Islander means, all of the identities that are housed there. Yeah, it really angered me. And that was definitely why I wanted to do my research project for my master's and continue that work, because that reasoning is so old and is so outdated.
Tired.
Played out. Done. Yes.
Played out. Done. Finito.
And even and now more than ever, with the consequences of the climate crisis getting stronger every year, like we can't keep saying that Pacific Islander communities are too small to justify having attention on them or having research on them. It just discounts so much, both in terms of like politics and policy, but also in terms of the beauty that the Pacific Islands and the people in them have to offer. Yeah.
Well, and why do you think Melanesians and Pacific Islanders more broadly have been erased from psychology research and practice?
Well, with just the numbers game of it and the perception that there are too few Pacific Islanders out there, even though when you put it all together, the amount of countries and the amount of identities within the term Pacific Islander definitely justifies research, but also just generally psychology and psychological research, especially some of the like tentpole theories out there, have a rap for being based on research samples that are very male, very pale. And especially as from my experience with American research, anyhow, it's a conversation that I always have to have with the people that I speak with about when it comes to things like diagnosis or different therapeutic approaches, where we need to take a pinch of salt here and there, because these books or these theories are usually based on samples of just American white men. And so let's look for where this does apply, where it doesn't apply. You got both of those things going in there, and they interact with each other, definitely.
So what does it mean to decolonize psychology in practical terms?
Part of it is making sure that we're using the right language with minority cultures. A lot of the times we can use terms that like continue to promote that otherness, like, oh, there's this, they have this strange way of doing that, or this really tiny population of the world does X, Y, or Z. Isn't that strange or isn't that different? No, it's just different from American norms. You know, that doesn't mean that it's wrong. And making sure that bias, whether explicit or implicit, isn't present when we come into therapeutic settings or into clinical settings. And this can look a lot of different ways. One of the big ones that was pointed out to me when I was talking with Dr. Jimmy Obed, a psychiatrist in Lenology, for my master's project, was the importance of the village for Islander clients. With at least my own experience with training, there's so much emphasis on we need to maintain privacy, we need to maintain privacy at all costs. And yes, that's true, but we also have to remember the importance of the fact that, yeah, someone's aunties or someone's mom or someone's dad or someone's pastor might be curious about this person and their well-being. And we need to make sure that if that's what the patient wants, that that's what they're able to have, you know, and they weren't shamed or made to think they're inconvenient for wanting that, because the community is such an important part of their health, and not just within healthcare communities, but also when they go home and when they're done treatment.
You're listening to Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Wendy Mockey, and I'm speaking with Gabrielle Tor. In the US and a lot of other Western countries, mental health is often treated as a solo journey. One person, one therapist, one diagnosis. But in the Pacific, healing is collective. It happens in villages, at funerals, at church, around food and family. Through your work, from webinars to grassroots mental health education, you've seen how that communal strength isn't just cultural. It's clinical. And it may be the key to what the Western system has been missing all along. What have you seen in Pacific communities that reflects mental health wisdom, even if it's not labeled that way?
I think the, like we were talking about, the importance of community, and not just in the big ways, but in the small ways as well, in ensuring that people don't feel isolated or alone. With my experience just as a clinician so far, you know, in the States, it's very individualistic, and that can lead to a lot of loneliness with folks that feel very isolated, aren't sure how to build community. And the wisdom that Pacific Islanders have to offer there is really detrimental. I think that, no, it's important to make sure that, like, we go visit our aunties and our uncles regularly, that we linger in the doorway for a while and, like, make and have long goodbyes, you know, and that isn't awkward or inconvenient or weird. It's just a part of an expression of affection and an expression of love, you know, and the importance of, yeah, if my neighbor is sick, I'm going to make them food and I'm going to bring it to them. Or, yeah, if I need to get downtown, I can hitch a ride with this person or that, you know. And having that kind of faith in your community overall is so special and is so detrimental to our overall health, I think. It makes such a difference, at least in my experience with my work, when people start to have experiences that confirm that, you know, the people around me are kind, you know, and even if I don't know them, the people around me are good and they care. And that can be so beneficial in terms of intentionality with community. And I think that Pacific Islanders and Melanesians just carry that culturally in a really beautiful way.
We really do. I mean, my relatives are always lingering by every doorway. They'll never leave, and we say goodbye at least 20 times before anybody else goes. So it's definitely, yeah, for me, I feel it's a way of just, like, knowing that we're always there for each other, and there's like a deep sense of love and care that we have for each other. What does well-being mean when it's defined by the village and not the individual?
I think well-being can be summed up in not just physical health and mental health in terms of the individual, but also in feeling like they're a part of something bigger than themselves. And that, and the fact that, hey, if I fall down, someone's there to help me get up, you know, and feeling like they have a sense of belongingness. It's one of our core needs, like food, water, shelter, and sleep. Yes, of course, but also time with the things that we love and enjoy, and a sense of family and a sense of connectedness are also really, really vital and important. And so in terms of community health, I think that's the big emphasis there. Having that sense of belonging to something outside of ourselves, that, like, no, I'm not just going home and it's just me and I'm alone with my thoughts. But hey, if I want to go out and like say hi to people or have dinner with folks or go to church or all of these other things, that those things are available for me as well.
For many Pacific Islanders, the climate crisis isn't theoretical, it's immediate. Disappearing shorelines, contaminated waters, intensifying cyclones. These aren't just environmental disasters, they're psychological ones as well. Your research has helped connect the dots, showing how environmental grief, cultural loss, and displacement shape mental health in ways that Western systems often fail to recognize or respond to. What are some of the stories or patterns you've heard that connect land loss to mental health?
I think just right off the bat, the most significant one is trauma and PTSD, especially with, like, rapidly increasing cyclones, both in intensity and in number, to things like the earthquakes on Oahu late last year, and just the way that it impacts people and their ability to to keep going, especially when they might be given very little chance to recover with things like the increasing cyclones and as the cyclone season gets longer. And with land loss, that also comes to the emotional side of losing land and maybe also customs that are tied to it, either with family or with their general community overall, and the pain that comes from that as well.
What role can mental health practitioners play in climate resilience, especially for the Pacific?
We just did a webinar in April, I believe. All right, time is very funny. that was all about the different things that people are doing for climate resilience. We got to hear from so many different people, from activists to scientists. And I think that is a really important factor with climate resilience, is digging into what people are doing to fight climate change, to benefit their communities, everything from mangrove replanting projects to classes and community centers teaching young people and kids about different customs for preserving the land and preserving the water and the fish and the wildlife and the fruit and everything. I know that was really, really special when we got to hear about that in that Melanesian Women Today webinar. And I think that's really important to highlight overall, that as these things are happening and the consequences of climate change, also there are so many people within Melanesia, within the greater Pacific Islands, that their life's work is combating climate change or preserving historical customs about conservation. Not just like these aren't exactly new techniques. They're ones that came from our ancestors, from the people that came 100 generations before us, and we're able to take that wisdom with us into the future. That is really special, not just for mental, emotional, but also spiritual health as well.
Now, you've completed your master's. Congratulations. That's incredible. You're working on community-based webinars, and now you're dreaming of a PhD. But more than anything, you want to stay in motion, to keep learning, keep sharing, and keep showing up for your community in ways that are culturally grounded, practical, and lasting, whether through research, storytelling, or one-on-one care. Your work is part of a growing movement, one led by Pacific people for Pacific people. What are your hopes for your own career and for the future of psychology in the Pacific?
For my personal career, yes, PhD is up there, definitely. I hope that I get to experiment with a lot of different things. I'm by day a clinician, a mental health clinician, but I really want to continue exploring teaching and research, specifically for the Pacific Islands and Melanesia, and how mental and emotional health can be applied, and not just applied, but the ways that Melanesian and Pacific Island cultural principles can influence how we understand mental and emotional health. Because there's so much for us to learn from just what makes our communities thrive. And for the future of psychology in general, I would say that at least I've noticed personally that there's been a wave of research within the last few years of really trying to push and broaden how psychology is understood in different cultures. And I want to be a part of that. I want to continue to help with pushing and testing out psychology and coming up with new theories and new principles and different ways that it can be applied in the Pacific Islands. And I just, my hope for the field in general is that we just stay connected to the spirit of this is about making sure that other people know how to take care of themselves and other people. I always say that, the point of all of this is to make sure that when we have hard times, we're able to get through them in a healthy way. That is personal heartbreaks and struggles, or things as big as climate change and natural disasters. So yeah, a lot of spinning wheels, and I just hope that I can continue to be a part of it.
What advice would you give young Pacific Islanders, and specifically Melanesians, who are trying to find their voice in academic or clinical spaces?
Oh my goodness, be courageous. I would say that, because looking back at my own journey so far, I feel like I spent a lot of energy wondering if I like would be perceived as good enough for things like my master's program and for pursuing independent research and to be a clinician. And that burnt up a lot of energy. And I don't want other people to have to go through that. I would say, yeah, be courageous and trust that you have something unique to say, especially with the previous attitudes of like, oh no, these places are too small. There's a lot that our fields don't know simply because they haven't been paying attention. So yeah, just trust that you have something unique and important to say, because you definitely do. And yeah, just continue to go for it. Because I remember when I was applying for my master's degree, or to get into my master's program, a part of me was like, maybe I'm missing that it factor, you know, that X factor that would make me a good student.
The X factor.
Yes, exactly. Like maybe there's something like, I don't know. And then I got offered a seat in the next cohort and I was like, oh, I guess that was wrong. And I just continued to roll with it. So yeah, I think long way around to saying, you know, be courageous and just trust that I have something important to say. I have something to contribute.
Yeah, excellent. Thank you. Now, this is the final question, and we ask this question of all our guests. If there is one thing about your culture that isn't widely known or celebrated, and you believe the world should understand, what would that be?
The principle of living in the present is something that my family and I talk about a lot when we're missing home. Just the difference between being here in the States, where everything is like hurry, hurry, rush, rush, we're already thinking about tomorrow, and the stress that can come from that, versus when we're home and in Vila. Someone told me this once, and I will never forget it. I was telling them, I hurried downtown, and it says why I could meet this specific deadline. And this person, they laughed and they said, huh. Only an American would take pride in how much they hurry, or only an American would take pleasure in hurrying. And I was like, oh my goodness, I suppose that's true. That's something that's taught. And in reality, there's so much joy and so much peace to be had with making sure that we're mindful and actually here in the present moment. There's a lot of health to that. So yeah.
Thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story with us today. Mental health matters in our communities. Your voice and your work you're doing is so powerful, but especially important for our people as Melanesians. But the language systems and structures meant to support it haven't always recognized the way that we live, grieve, or care for each other. And your work reminds us that culture isn't just an afterthought. It's central to how we understand pain, how we hold each other, how we heal. And if the systems around us can't see that, then they need to change. And your work challenges us to think bigger about who gets seen in the data, whose healing counts, and what it means to build frameworks that honor our full selves. Gabrielle, thank you for confronting the limits of Western psychology and for placing Melanesian knowledge at the center and not at the margins. Thank you for listening. You've been listening to Stories from the Pacific, presented by me, Wendy Mockey, and produced by Jaden Mailata. If you like this episode and want more, be sure to listen to other episodes in our program by searching up Stories from the Pacific on our website or wherever you get your podcasts. This story was produced on the lands of the Yagara and Turrbal people.
Salo Falava, I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Reiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific to celebrate our resilience, revival, and deep-rooted connection.
Search for Culture Compass wherever you get your podcasts to listen.